Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Good afternoon, evening. First, I'd like to thank SILRAP and all the organizers for this opportunity and Professor Bergsmo. The topic of my presentation is humanity and unity, Indian thought and collective legal goods protected by international criminal law. In this presentation, I intend to put forth arguments primarily based in Indian philosophical thought for the elevation of the value of unity to a collective legal good. One of the focuses of this project is analyzing foundational concepts in international criminal law. Through my research, I have found that there may not be much consideration for ICL jurisprudence when it comes to prosecuting grave crimes in the country, and India may not be a party to the Rome Statute. But the fundamental legal goods that ICL protects, like humanity, has strong foundations in Indian philosophy. Before I begin, I'd like to give you a roadmap of how my presentation will progress. I start with the applicability of the legal goods theory in international criminal law. Then I move on to the test for evaluating what value could be elevated to the standing of a legal good within the discipline of ICL. This test I've derived from Roxon's definition of legal goods. Next, I move on to the notion of humanity as recognized under ICL and the protection afforded to humanity under Indian philosophy to show that Indian thought recognizes humanity as a legal good to be protected. Thereafter, I address the place for unity within Indian philosophical thought. Here I explain the idea of unity of existence and whether such an idea passes the twofold test for elevating a value to a legal good. I then move on to the advantages of elevating unity to a legal good, and I finally address the importance of importing a concept of Indian philosophy to ICL. The parameters of my research are as follows. I have consulted the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita because these are the primary texts of Indian philosophy, and I felt them to be most relevant to my study. The school of thought within which the research is conducted is the Advaita Vedanta, or the non-dualist school of Indian philosophy, within the Astika or Orthodox school of Indian philosophy. For this reason, the term Indian philosophy and the term Vedantic philosophy are used interchangeably during the course of the presentation. Now, the reason I have chosen humanity delimiting other international law legal goods is because humanity, like unity, is a concept which is abstract in its formulation, but underlines the substantive nature of the entire discipline and how it functions. The concept of humanity has been the topic of long-standing debate as to what the notion means within the context of ICL. But today, humanity has gained very strong statutory backing in ICL, and violation of it is prosecutable under the subject matter jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Unity, too, is an abstract concept, but at the same time is an equally important value, the consideration of which is necessary for carrying out the aspirations of international criminal law vis-a-vis the future, which are the non-commission of grave crimes and securing a peaceful world. Now, moving on to the first section of my presentation, Roxon defined legal goods as conditions or chosen ends useful either to the individual and his free development within the context of an overall social system or to the functioning of the system itself. It is a criminal law, specifically German criminal law, posits the sole function of criminal law to be the protection of legal goods, and actions which violate or threaten these legal goods are to be penalized. I believe that this theory of criminal law has had a significant influence on the criminal law of other civil law nations, but I believe it also is echoed within the ICL discipline. This is primarily due to the wording of the preamble of the Rome Statute, which states, grave crimes threaten the peace, security, and well-being of the world, and signatory states affirm that the most serious crimes of concern to the international community as a whole must not go unpunished and that their effective prosecution must be ensured. So looking at the preamble as a tool for interpretation, it can be said that the discipline of ICL seeks to protect peace, security, and well-being of the world by prosecuting the grave crimes that threaten it. Now, drawing parallels from Roxon's definition, the test for elevating a value to the standing of a legal good within ICL could be One, it should be essential for the free development of the individual. And second, considering the international society to be a social system, it must be essential for fostering the international peace and security and friendly relations between states. Now, humanity as a legal good. I'm not going to talk much about this because Professor Lam has spoken very well about it. But I'd just like to say that during the time of World War I, during the Armenian Genocide, there was a lot of debate as to whether crimes against humanity could be prosecuted as separate from war crimes. However, after the Holocaust, states were willing to put aside the principle of legality and prosecute crimes against humanity as a separate crime. Therefore, crimes against humanity became prosecutable by the very heinousness it posed, even though it was affected by ex post facto legislation. So the violation of such a conception of humanity must have been so grave that it would have shocked the collective conscience of all of mankind, and the protection of this value would have been prevalent in every school of thought. Indian thought supports the notion of humanity as a legal good. The notion of humanity is essentially a qualitative value indicating the conduct of one person towards another person. According to Indian philosophical thought, humanity is more inward-looking and in the realm of self-reflection. But the outcome of such self-reflection results in how one treats another person. According to Vedantic thought, individual conduct must be regulated to attain salvation or moksha, which is regulated by the theory of karma and the theory of rebirth. The Bhagavad Gita lays down essential virtues and vices. The virtues, according to the Gita, include purity of heart, compassion to beings, freedom from malice and hatred, etc. Whereas the vices include anger, rudeness, giving to injuring others, and the like. These are the divine treasures for the purposes of liberation and heritage of demons for bondage. The Gita states, it goes on to state, that holding such a view, that is holding on to demonic tendencies, these lost souls of little understanding and fierce deeds rise as the enemies of the world for its destruction, giving themselves up to insatiable desires. Full of hypocrisy, pride, and arrogance, they hold false views through delusion and act with impure resolve. Further, it goes, the Lord says, these cruel haters, these evildoers, these vilest of men, I hurl always into the wombs of the demons in the cycle of births and death. Therefore, if the virtues are practiced, it will lead to a higher rebirth, and practice of vices will lead to a lower rebirth, according to the theory of karma. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad also states the importance of compassion. There's a passage in it which talks about the importance of compassion, which goes like this. Then the demon said to him, please instruct us, sir. To them he uttered the same syllable, da, and asked, have you understood? They replied, we have. You have said to us, be compassionate, which is short for dayadham. He then said, yes, you have understood. That very thing is repeated even today by the heavenly voice in the form of thunder. Da, 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 which means control yourself, give, and have compassion. Therefore, one should learn these three, self-control, giving, and mercy. We should try to be at peace with all and abhor all cruelty and ill will. So human beings have demonic and godlike tendencies. But these demonic tendencies must be suppressed and compassion must be practiced to attain a higher rebirth and eventually moksha. This is akin to the definition of crimes against humanity and genocide. The host of prohibited actions under the two categories of crimes are the greatest atrocities that human beings can commit against each other, in the words of David Luban, and have been variously described as evil acts displaying demonic tendencies. So giving effect to Indian thought, practicing or committing any of these actions will lead to a lower rebirth. Therefore, not only does ICL prohibit them, but also the law of karma in Indian thought. Now, how is unity recognized under Indian philosophy? Whereas the notion of humanity in Indian philosophy guides individual conduct, the notion of unity guides the conduct of persons in a society. The fundamental dogma of Vedantic thought is the unity of existence. The 108 Upanishads are constant in reaffirming that every living thing is a manifestation of a metaphysical concept called Brahman. Brahman is the sole non-being from which every living thing in the universe arises, is sustained by, and ultimately goes back to. Therefore, the Brahman actualizes itself into the world. It does not only create the world, but it becomes it. This power of actualization that the Brahman has to multiply itself into forms and shapes and enter into these forms and shapes to give it life is called Maya or illusion. So from the perspective of Indian thought, the whole world and all of its components is a magic show. Even this room is an illusion. The 40 or 50, 70 people sitting here do not actually exist. All that exists is the singular reality, Brahman. And we see 40 or 50 people because of the operation of Maya or illusion on our brains. So the multiple forms in the universe, human beings, plants, etc., are sustained by Maya, and we as human beings are unable to perceive the singular reality, Brahman, because of being bound down by avidya or ignorance. Therefore, when two individuals are differentiated and a relationship is established between them, Vedantic philosophers would call such a relationship Maya or illusion. Vedantic thought supports the notion that when the singularity of Brahman is realized, there is no differentiation between the perceiver and the perceived, as both the perceiver and the perceived are Brahman, and a perfected soul does not look upon others with differentiation. There are various metaphors given in the Upanishads to stress the fact that the Brahman manifests itself. For example, sparks from a fire, the sparks being every living being that exists, and the Brahman being the fire, spokes from a wheel, drops of water from the ocean. This unity of existence and the idea that there is no differentiation between any living entity in the world and no multiplicity whatsoever is stated in various ways in the Upanishads. I'll just quote a few. The Katha Upanishad says, what is here, the same is there, and what is there, the same is here. He goes from death to death who sees any difference here. Again, it states, by the mind alone is Brahman to be realized. Then one does not see in it any multiplicity whatsoever. He goes from death to death who sees multiplicity in it. This verily is that. Then the Isa Upanishad says, the wise man beholds all beings in the self and the self in all beings. For that reason, he does not hate anyone. And finally, again, the Katha Upanishad, which states, to the seer, all things have verily become the self. What delusion, what sorrow can there be for him who beholds this oneness? Therefore, the Advaita Vedanta philosophy explains the unity of existence as every living entity being a self-projection of the Brahman, and there is no multiplicity whatsoever. The teaching of Vedanta demonstrates the ultimate reality of Brahman. Sarvam Khalvidam Brahma, all that exists is Brahma. To take an example of this, within the Rwandan genocide, the majority Hutus exterminated Tutsis, but according to Indian philosophical thought, it was the Brahman having manifested himself as both the Hutus and the Tutsis. So it was, in essence, the Hutus exterminating themselves. Now, does this concept of unity pass the legal good test? The first point that needs to be addressed is it necessary for individual development? Perceiving differences which do not actually exist from the perspective of Indian thought may lead to conflict. These differences may take the form of ethnicity, different languages spoken, historical experiences, etc. A situation of armed conflict hampers an individual from enjoying the rights and liberties that are afforded to him by the state, which are essential for his free development. Therefore, recognition of unity is a necessary precondition for there to be an absence of armed conflict, which is imperative for the free development of an individual. Second, is it necessary for international peace and security? ICL must not only, in my opinion, aim at achieving a situation where armed conflict does not exist, but rather it should foster a situation where there is no rivalry or competition between nations and an increased international cooperation. Consideration of unity by international law and policy makers could be an effective way in increasing friendly relations. It can also be a tool for interpretation when passing judicial orders. Recognition of unity may be a key driving force in fostering friendly relations between states. Next, what are the possible advantages of elevating unity to the standing of a legal good? The primary advantage lies in public international law. As already stated before, it can be a good to be considered by international law and policy makers, and a tool for interpretation by courts and arbitrators. Unity of nations can also contribute to the strength and efficacy of treaties and conventions. Particularly in the case of ICL, it can guide the category of crimes that could be added to the future discipline of ICL. It can be essential for developing stability between nations. As an underlying consideration in the reparative theory of justice, and in the formulation of a new category of crimes, namely crimes against environment. I'm going to expand on the last two. ICL today recognizes reparation as one of the purposes it seeks to achieve, and as such, it has a victim-centered approach, with due recognition being given to victims within the Rome Statute and the ICC being called the Victims' Court. The Van Bowen Principles is the principal document governing reparations, and under this, the species include restitution, compensation, guarantees of non-repetition, satisfaction, and rehabilitation. But as Justice Bhargavanath pointed out, that reconciliation is an extremely important aspect which has not yet been included into the discipline of ICL, and it is suggested that reconciliation should also be recognized as a species of reparation in the treaty itself, and even in the treaty itself. Article 75 of the ICC statute states reparation orders to be of three types. It can include restitution, compensation, and rehabilitation. Reconciliation should also be added as one of these categories. And second, a state is required to render reparation, and this is due to good reason that the person who commits the crime must be responsible for it. Within ICC, the court can also make an order directly against the convicted person. But it is suggested that reparation must not only be looked at as a sanction, but rather as an opportunity for fostering unity. Therefore, reparations can be a chance for the international community to unify and compensate a war-torn society. Next, in the category of crimes against environment, the unity of existence means that whether an organism is human being or is a plant or an animal is only an illusion. Therefore, I as a human being am no different from plants or trees or any other aspect of the natural environment. Armed conflict can lead to a large-scale destruction of the natural environment. The preamble of the Rome Statute states that the ICC has jurisdiction over the most serious crimes of concern to the international community as a whole. Environmental degradation is a cause for global concern and is an action that transcends national boundaries and must be recognized as such a serious crime. Therefore, going by ICL should recognize the solidarity with natural environment due to the operation of the concept of unity of existence and regard the environment the same as human beings and social institutions it seeks to protect and safeguard it as such. The current international criminal law framework for protection of environment is not very robust. First, it is not recognized as a separate crime. It is included within the war crimes division. Additionally, it is not a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions. And this limited protection is given only when there is an international armed conflict. There is no protection in the case of a non-international armed conflict. So it is suggested that crimes against environment be included as a separate crime. And finally, why must a concept of Indian philosophy be imported to ICL? Historically, the foundations of international law lie in the development of Western culture and the growth of the Westphalian model of sovereignty, and as such is seen as being Eurocentric or Western in its approach, especially in light of third world approaches scholarship. But the dawn of the 21st century requires that the continued development of the law of nations be influenced not only by Western culture, but also Eastern thought. Philosophical and religious thought is a major influencer of laws in India. Almost all the personal laws within the country are religious traditions and practices which have been concretized into legal norms. A large number of criminal and civil laws also find basis in Indian thought and the theories of statecraft as written by ancient philosophers such as Kautilya. A truly global international law would require inclusion of Indian thought in the legal framework. Additionally, a large part of humanity lives in India, almost one-fifth of the world's population being indirectly affected by the outcome of international policy. Specifically referring to international criminal law, India is not a party to the Rome Statute. Consideration of Indian philosophical thought in the growth of the discipline of ICL may be an impetus for India to become a signatory to the Rome Statute. Finally, it becomes important to look towards philosophy when legal norms cannot effectively address ill-defined situations in gray areas. An emphasis of philosophy can lead to the structured growth of a discipline like ICL, which wants to achieve a very substantial task. It is concerned with prosecuting great crimes, the likes of which can be remedied by no form of punishment. Philosophy can guide the discipline in creating an environment wherein peace is the foundational world order and in developing conditions which do not require the perpetration of grave crimes, thereby achieving a situation where the institution created by the very discipline, the International Criminal Court, does not have a need to exist anymore. The ICC, as a conclusion, to stress the importance of philosophy in any field, I would like to quote Dr. Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, the first Vice President of India, and a reputed Oriental scholar from his book, The Principal Upanishads. At a time when moral aggression is compelling people to capitulate to queer ways of life, when vast experiments in social structure and political organization are being made at enormous cost of life and suffering, when we stand perplexed and confused before the future with no clear light to guide our way, the power of the human soul is the only refuge. If we resolve to be governed by it, our civilization may enter upon its most glorious epoch. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.